non-rock a boatus must stop. I don't want to rock the boat. I want to sink it.
Are you going to bark all day, little doggy? Or are you going to bite?
Brett, delusional
is okay in your worldview. I'm an animal. You don't chastise chickens for being delusional. You don't chastise pigs for being delusional. So you calling me delusional using your worldview is perfectly okay. It doesn't really hurt.
She hung up on me.
Yes!
Oh!
Yes!
What?
What?
Desperate times call for faithful men and not for careful men. The careful men come later and write the biographies of the faithful men, lauding them for their courage.
Go into all the world and make disciples. Not go into the world and make buddies. Not to make brosives.
Right.
Don't go into the world and make homies.
Right.
Disciples.
I got a bit of a jiggle neck. That's a joke, Pastor.
When we have the real message of truth, we cannot let somebody say they're speaking truth when they're not.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of Apologia Radio, coming at you guys from Phoenix, Arizona. This is the gospel heard around the world. I am Jeff Durbin. They call me the Ninja, and that is Luke the Bear Pearson.
What up?
And I'm surrounded by Joy the Girl Timby.
Surrounded by.
Hey. I don't even know what that means.
And, of course, we have on the ones and twos, Marcus, King Ginger Pittman.
How's it going?
We're all joy here.
Yes. We're ready for another show, guys. An important show. Good show today. Excited about it. I really, really am. And just so you know, this is a show that's been in the works for, I don't know, like 2 years? Something like that. Close to two years.
Probably.
Year and a half, something like that.
It's been a while.
So it is about time we actually had it. We're going to talk about how silly atheists are for thinking science belongs to them. We're going to talk about God, his existence, the philosophical foundation for the uniformity in nature, science at all being possible in our world, how you have to have Christ at the center to make sense of any of that. So we're going to have a good show today talking about science and the biblical worldview, and we have somebody in the studio today that is a member of Apologia Church. Make sure I read everything correctly here, actually, I get this right. He is a PhD. His name is Kyle Staggs. He is adjunct faculty, College of Science, Engineering, and Technology of Grand Canyon University. He is, he's a super nerd.
He's Dr. Super Smart.
He's Super Smart Kyle. Super Smart Kyle. Welcome to the show, Super Smart Kyle.
Thanks for having me on, you guys. I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to getting to talk about some of the fun stuff we get to go over today.
That's right. So you can already tell.
It's a very scientific answer.
He's already talking like an engineer and very scientific. And we've already told Kyle that he needs to dumb things down for us so that we can understand. And but before we do the show, Kyle, we're just going to open up the show in this segment. And we have something that was said about Apologia Radio is we go from silly to searing in seconds. Silly to searing in seconds. That's what
and
I mean.
Now we can add smart.
It's our very favorite review ever. Silly to Searing in Seconds with Smart Kyle.
Super smart.
Super smart. Silly to Searing in Seconds with Super Smart Kyle. Okay. Joy, what's up?
So speaking of searing, you guys know.
Careful how you say that. You might make my phone go off.
What? Oh, yeah. Siri.
Is it searing.
Hey, Siri.
It does it all the time when I say, are you serious? And then it'll go, can I help you?
Are you serious?
Apple.
But it's not your voice. It's not my voice.
Oh, it knows just your voice?
Yeah.
That's creepy.
I know.
AI is taking over
the
world.
Are you saying my voice sounds like your voice?
No, I'm saying it would only respond to my voice. And never mind.
Anyway.
I was making a joke.
Okay, so speaking of searing, that was my joke, but it's now forgotten because you made it about you.
That's always about you.
You guys know I always like to bring you the most important news of the day.
Always.
Always.
5 years, that's what we expect of you.
So I'm here to tell you guys today about a new pop-up restaurant called The Spotted Cheetah, which is a Cheetos-sponsored pop-up restaurant that's The chef is Anne Burrell. If you guys watch the Food Network,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
okay, okay. She has
crazy blonde hair.
Right, yeah,
right.
And so it's too late to go. So sorry if you want to go because all the spots are already filled. Supposedly it was like.
Well, why are we talking about this?
The moment they started taking reservations, it was like minutes.
Is Pop Up here locally, Phoenix?
No.
No, well, then why are we talking about this? We're getting all excited.
It's a Cheetos restaurant.
I get all excited.
Okay, so it's a Cheetos restaurant. Okay. And it has Cheetos and everything, and they even have dessert.
Do you have like a?
I have the menu.
You can have like a chicken strip?
If you guys
fried in Cheetos?
Okay. So they have fried pickles. They have grilled cheese and tomato soup. They have a meatball.
Oh.
They have a fried green tomato, mac and cheese, nachos, tacos, and then they have what they call Sweetos. So Cheetos, Sweetos crusted cheesecake,
sweet
and salty cookies, white cheddar Cheetos, and Cheetos Sweetos apple crepes.
Wow.
I don't know how I feel about that.
Do they have the fiery hot Cheetos?
They do. They put all, they use all the different Cheetos depending on the dish, like what works best for which dish. But I believe the mac and cheese has the Flamin' Hot Cheetos on top of it.
That's really important.
Flamin' Hot Flamin' Hoppers. Flamin' Hopper. Flamin' Hot Cheetos are not good for the gut.
No, they're not.
My children have learned that lesson several times. Mm-hmm. Like, you know that's going to be bad for you later. They're like, I just love them, Dad, so much.
The main thing is that when you eat a whole bag of Flamin' Hot Cheetos.
Right.
Which
is what they do.
For chips, I think the general rule is that you're not supposed to eat like the whole family-sized bag in one sitting. But we've all been there.
I remember years ago when I was in high school, somebody came from California to Washington, D.C., and they brought like bags and bags and bags of Flamin' Hot Cheetos with them. You couldn't get them East Coast. And so I used to love traveling to California, and I would make a special stop just to get Flamin' Hot Cheetos somewhere. But now we're just inundated with them, and they're not good for me, so I try to avoid them.
If you either, does it come with an insulin shot? Because you might leave with Cheetobitis.
Cheetobitis?
Cheetobitis. Diacheetus.
Cheetobitis.
Wow. Not that I'm aware of, but I thought it was hilarious and amazing.
Hey, let me just say that as Luke gets older, his dad joke game gets
stronger.
Fire.
It's straight.
Like Flaming Hot Cheetos.
When you say pop-up restaurant, I picture you like a pop-up book and you open it up and there's the restaurant.
Anytime you say pop-up,
that's
what I think
exactly
of.
The concept.
That's why.
It just pops up in a store and then it's gone.
Yeah, that's not fair though. Because when you do something like that, it's just not right to give us something so amazing and then just walk away. It's like, just leave you hanging. And
just that's like, people do things for a short amount of time. What?
It's like Chick-fil-A spicy. It's like Chick-fil-A spicy breakfast biscuits.
Right. Yeah.
Why
those
you
are
do
good.
That?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
They got bomb biscuits and gravy.
If
by
you're
going
to commit to something, just go all
Chick-fil-A
the way.
Does. Right.
No end in sight. That's my philosophy.
I know. We all know.
With sermons and anything. Yeah, that's how I do it.
You only stop when someone like begs you desperately.
Yeah.
When your body fails,
please,
that's when you stop.
Please stop.
I usually figure it's time to wrap the sermon up when I see all the bodies on the floor of the children. I'm like, okay, we're good. We've done it.
There's always, at the end of service, there's always at least one kid just passed out in some chairs.
That's right. That's how you do it. That's how you know you're preaching well. When Paul preached, a man fell asleep out the window. And I figure
that's where you got that from.
I'm just saying, it's a regular principle. Like, you know, I look at the Bible to figure, how do I do this? I see a man falling asleep out of a window, and so I wait for that. I just wait for
that's
it.
That's your cue.
Oh, that's amazing.
I'm just following the Bible, that's all. Speaking of following the Bible, let's start talking. You ready, Kyle? You ready, super smart Kyle?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so let's lay down some foundations. First and foremost, especially for our new listeners, we've done some important shows on this topic. We've done public debates, and we have lots of stuff up on our Apologia Studios YouTube channel, actual dialogue and interaction with people who are atheists and agnostics. Let's just start at the bottom, fundamental, the most important thing, and that is that you have to have a foundation to make sense of the study of the world. So let me just say this, it's very important. It's very easy for image bearers of God in God's world to just assume uniformity in nature, to just assume that laws of logic are necessary, unchanging, and universal. It's just too easy for an image bearer of God in God's world to assume that there are ethical standards by which we must abide with in order to have discussions about science and evidence and facts and those sorts of things. Now, let me just say that for everyone who's like maybe new to this discussion and you're just beginning to take to really leap into this, there is a lot of borrowed capital going on in terms of unbelievers borrowing from God in order to make sense of their worldview. And so very simply, you have to borrow from the Christian worldview in order to make sense of reality, your experience, ethical absolutes, laws of logic, science. And so what you do see in the world is men like Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Lawrence Krauss, go down the line of all the well-known atheists, physicists, biologists who reject God's existence. What you see commonly, what is common affair with them, is to attack Christians by saying that they're the rational ones, they're the scientific ones, and we're the blind faith religionists. But that's just too easy. And there have been enough good atheist philosophers to point this out to them. You can't just have this stuff as a gimme. In other words, when the atheist chastises the Christian and says, you don't get to have science, we do, we're atheists, that's just too easy. We're not going to allow that. We're not going to give you the gimme. Like, just give me uniformity in nature. Just give me a rational universe. Just give me immaterial laws of arithmetic, or they would say in the UK, maths. Just give me ethical absolutes so I can gather enough arguments against God's existence. You have to have a worldview by which you can make sense of your appeals to science, to logic, to ethical absolutes. And if we come from, say, and we're going to play clips today from Dawkins. So if we come from a position that Dawkins gives to us, where he says that there is no good, there is no evil, only blind and pitiless indifference. If you take his anthropology, his view of mankind, and say that, okay, granted, I'll take a bite of that. I am the descendant of highly evolved societies of bacteria. I'm an African ape. We got here through unpurposed, unguided processes that got us to where we are today. We are all just stardust in a universe that doesn't care. If I take that position, I have no coherent, meaningful basis to appeal to uniformity in nature, the principle of induction, which is necessary for all of science, that the future will be like the past. I have no basis to appeal to ethical absolutes in terms of if I'm dialoguing with a person, having the expectation that they are going to hold to absolute laws of honesty and integrity in giving information back to me. Also, ethical absolutes in terms of not beating the person over the head with a club if they don't agree with me or something to that effect. And so also the issue of laws of logic as immaterial, universal, abstract, unchanging laws that I must hold to, or the issue of arithmetics, immaterial, universal, unchanging laws of arithmetic. Now, here's the thing. If I take Dawkins' claim about the origin of the universe and humanity, he robs me now of my ability to even engage in the discussion. Without Jesus as the principium, the Word of God as the principium, as the source, the standard, I can't appeal to any of these things in any meaningful way. And so that's what's really important. First and foremost, in this discussion, we are not saying that we appeal to these evidences apart from a worldview in which they can make sense. If you don't have Christ, you don't have science. If you don't have Christ, you don't have laws of logic. If you don't have Christ, you don't have laws of arithmetic. If you don't have Christ, you don't have ethical absolutes. That's just the way that it is. And I'm not the first person to say something like that to someone like Dawkins or Krauss or Dennett or Harris. There have been plenty of good philosophers that would challenge him on some of his points. For example, last thing I'll say to this, Bertrand Russell, gotta respect the man, wrote one of the most famous atheist tomes in history, Why I'm Not a Christian. In his book, Problems in Philosophy, he addresses the issue of the principle of induction, which is at the bottom of all of our experience. And what that essentially is don't let it throw you. Don't let the phrase throw you. It is necessary. You're appealing to it right now. And that is that all of us live with the expectation that the future will be like the past. No science is possible without it. Mm-hmm. Flying in airplanes isn't possible without the principle of induction. Walking your doggy isn't possible without the principle of induction. And so what Bertrand Russell, an atheist philosopher, says to somebody who, say, holds to his position, he's addressing the problem of induction. He says, give me a justification for the future being like the past. It's necessary for everything we do. And he says, and if you say, well, it always has been uniform in the past, he says, you're arguing in a circle and not answering the problem. Mm-hmm. Nobody's asking you what the past has been. How do we have a meaningful way to approach the uniformity in nature, saying that the future will be like the past, the past experiences will be congruent with future experiences? How do we do it? And basically, Bertrand Russell essentially said, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And neither do you. And David Hume, Scottish skeptic, in his problem of induction, says the same thing. He essentially said this: when I think about the problem of induction, which is necessary for everything we do, he says, I like to sit back into my easy chair and just drink scotch because I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer. I don't know. And wouldn't you know it? Without Jesus, you can't know. There is no certainty. You have nothing to stand on. And so all of this is borrowed capital. Quickly, I'll play this clip from Richard Dawkins talking about creationists. We'll take a break, come back, and listen to Super Smart Kyle about science and God.
Look at the history of religion and be fascinated by it, just as we look at the history of art and so on. But I don't think that religion has anything useful to teach us.
Says the man who teaches or taught at a university built by Christianity.
Right.
Says the man who walked under like arches at the university. It says, in his light, we see light. Yeah, we got nothing to offer you, Richard.
One of the main reasons why people are religious is because they're persuaded by the apparent design of living things. And that's completely destroyed by Darwin. If you actually read any book by a biologist about evolution, it's hard to see how you could fail to be persuaded of it. It's, I mean, the evidence is just absolutely pat. There's no doubt about it. It's not a controversial issue.
I'm sorry, there's 2 minutes left. I can't play. We got to stop right there. I can't give us too much to think about, especially because we have Super Smart Kyle over there just shaking his head. And so
notice how he never actually gives any evidence.
Okay,
he's like, well, there's plenty of evidence. You can't.
Go ahead.
Oh, he's like, can't argue with this. There's just so much evidence, but he never gives any.
1 minute, Kyle. Give us your thoughts.
It's interesting that he points that out, and like Luke says, he doesn't give you any counter evidence. He just says, well, the evidence is overwhelming, as if the science is settled, and you read this book that's written from one biased perspective that gives you only selected information, and from that you're supposed to automatically glean the truth. Well, only an idiot gleans truth from a singular point source on a lot of these topics. You want all of this information to converge and point you to one inescapable conclusion. That's how we're able to conduct science in the first place. And so he's sort of sitting there doing some underhanded trickery, which is particularly interesting.
Well, yeah.
That was a pretty good answer.
It's the dogma of scientism, Dawkins scientism. So we will be right back, guys. Quick break and more with Super Smart Kyle. That's your official title now, Kyle. Hope you like it. Be right back, guys. ApologiaRadio.com is where you get more. Don't forget to sign up for All Access. When you do, you make everything we do possible, including the debates, the discussions on the street, everything that goes around the world, seen by millions and millions of people. It's all made possible by you guys. So partner with us, guys. Be right back.
For 21 years and counting, New St. Andrew's College has sought to obey Christ's great commission to disciple nations and build him a house. Not just in Jerusalem, but throughout the world. Not with stones and mortar, but with living stones. We build and fight. This is the task of a Christian liberal arts college, to equip students with the tools to build and fight. And this is our joyful task as we seek to graduate leaders who shape culture through wise and victorious living. To learn more, check us out online at nsa.edu/explore.
This is the Chocolate Knox. If you love that wonderful sensation of chewing glass, this is the show for you.
Cross Politic is a weekly show and podcast that mixes the taboo formula of faith, culture, and politics, proclaiming the lordship of Christ in every corner of our culture.
Hallelujah.
Gabriel Wrench is a deacon from Texas, and he wears overalls.
One time.
Chocolate Knox, a.k.a. David Shannon. He's a movie maker from Minnesota.
Action!
I'm Toby Sumter, pastor here in Moscow, Idaho, and I used to live in Alaska. Did you know that?
No.
No.
We've interviewed everyone from Alveda King to Ted Cruz to Steve Dace to Walter Williams, and we invite you to join us here at Cross Politic as we learn to fight, laugh, and feast, all to the glory of God. CrossPolitik.com.
We've done a lot of shows on the defense of the faith, biblical worldview, philosophy, foundations, those sorts of things. So that's why I'm super excited about today's show, because we have a brother in Christ, a member of Apologia Church, super smart Kyle, PhD. I just made it better, didn't I?
Yeah.
Super smart Kyle, PhD.
To be clear, it's because I worked hard, not because I'm some sort of super genius.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, that's true.
I might have a disagreement. I think it's both.
Yeah.
That's all.
Check out the big brain on Kyle.
He's super smart.
Yeah, he is.
He didn't take all the hard work. He was smart before he did the hard work.
And then he did hard work and made himself even better.
Then
he made himself
just smart.
Uber smart.
He was just smart, Kyle. Now he's super smart.
Maybe it should
PhD.
Be uber smart Kyle, PhD. Okay, so let's go ahead and just play a little bit more of this clip from Dawkins just to get sort of something to shoot at, and then we'll move from
I'll
there.
Sit on my tongue.
Okay, all right. Here we go.
As certain as the fact that the Earth and the other planets orbit the sun.
So macroevolution is as certain as the planets orbiting the sun. Something you could observe in the moment, right now, right? And his position is it's as certain as that.
Which I don't know how he can justify anything being certain to begin with.
Right, he doesn't have any certainty.
Yeah.
More than 40% of the American population, if opinion polls are to be believed, think that the world is less than 10,000 years old. And that's a shocking figure. It shows deep, profound ignorance. It sounds very laudable to teach the controversy, to teach both theories, but there aren't two theories. There's only one theory around. There's only one game in town as far as serious science is concerned. Of course, you get negative reactions from creationists, but who cares about creationists? They don't know anything.
Okay, that's good. Well, that's a good way to open the show.
He's a pompous man, isn't he?
Sadly, he's come into this conversation a little uninformed, so this will be interesting.
Well, let's talk about that, Kyle. So we've laid down the foundations that because we're Christians, we can have an appeal to uniformity in nature, that the universe is observable, that we can appeal to our senses and experience to even examine things. We can appeal to universal and necessary laws of logic. We have ethical standards right now that, Kyle, you're appealing to, like we can't sit here on this episode and lie through our teeth.
No, we absolutely can't.
I mean,
it's important to understand why Solomon laid down Proverbs 1:7, where he says the beginnings of knowledge is the fear of the Lord.
Right.
To ignore that willfully and proceed forward is, in fact, foolishness.
Yes. So get us into the discussion now. You're a scientist. You have spent your life training in this field, understanding the world and experience, examining things, taking different ideas and experiments and bringing them together to come to conclusions. Dawkins says you don't know anything, Kyle. You're ignorant. Ignorant for believing the Bible, ignorant for rejecting the dogma of the day. And so talk to that for a minute.
So I think it's interesting to just take this head on and make a counterpoint that Dr. Dawkins is, in fact, uninformed. I'm going to read a couple excerpts here from a Berkeley article from UC Berkeley talking about the restructuring fundamentally of what we used to think of as the tree of evolution, understanding that at this point in time, Darwinian evolution is simply dead. Factually speaking, it's not a thing. It's not taught as a thing anymore in school. So one of the things that I thought was interesting is this article says, and I quote, scientists have not yet identified the original single-celled organism from which all plants evolved, or the first land plant, or the first flowering plant, but they're on the scent. They go on to talk about a flower that's only growing in one particular island, and then it's some Amberella, some cream-colored flower. So they say that's the oldest one they've identified. They later close this article by saying, for a long time, scientists thought that red, green, and brown plants acquired different kind of chloroplasts at different times, but now it appears that all chloroplasts stem from one group of blue-green bacteria that are in fact more closely related to one another than are the plants themselves. For that matter, it now appears that all forms of life, all forms of higher life rather, for all their division, are more closely related than it is commonly believed. People are closer to green plants, for example, than to the E. coli that inhabit the human intestinal tract, and closer still to fungi, which is to say, you are actually genetically more closely related to the mushrooms on your salad than you are to the bacteria that are naturally present in your gut. One consequence of this relationship, they go on to say, experts say, is that treating the fungal infections of people is an exacting business, and the wrong treatment might harm the person as well as the fungus. Humans are brothers and sisters, not just to each other, it seems, but to the rest of life as well. This was an article that was copywritten, I think, in 1999. So this is not exactly new information, but this is information that they don't want you to have direct access to, because when I do exactly as he suggests and study this, what I come up with is this idea that, well, okay, evolution isn't actually the way that they explained it to us in grade school, so now what is it? There's no longer such a thing even as a tree of life. In this evolutionary theory, there's this idea of a circle of life where they're saying, gee, all of these cells are really closely related. That, in this day and age of scientific enlightenment, we need to look at models of creationism and models of evolution and say which of these evidences matches more closely with one model or the other. And we assign that evidence to that particular model. So in this case, that sounds like all of life is in fact very closely related genetically. And so that is actually consistent with more of a creation model than it is with an evolutionary model, because there's not this linear progression of one thing developed into all of the other things. It's one sort of design implemented in all of these other creative ways.
Okay. So what you just said a moment ago was, Dawkins promotes this Darwinian model, saying Darwin explained it all, we knew from there, it's a certainty, that's the fact. What you're saying is that now in the scientific world, what you're learning is that's not even accepted. Darwin did not have it right.
No, he did not. And that's one of those interesting points that even our understanding now of the very nature of the universe has changed significantly in the last few years. And one of the things that I've found particularly interesting is sort of this whole topic of like dark matter and dark energy, and
yes,
this idea that I've read some recent articles that I think put it reasonably well. One of them was by an essay to a journal, a very high profile journal called Nature. It was an essay written by Richard Con Henry in 2005, and he said the title was Concept: The Mental Universe. And he starts out by pointing out that there's a lot of people who really don't understand the nature of the universe anymore, and that these human constructs we're using to measure things are as subjective and restricted in their viewpoint as the act of observation itself. He closes this article with the idea that the universe is, quote, immaterial, mental, and spiritual, live and enjoy. There's this idea coming out in science that because we really don't fundamentally understand gravity and light, we can't rigorously define all of the things around us in the universe. What we can measure of the gravity tells us that there's some 95% of the universe that we simply cannot directly measure with our instruments. So the vast majority of what measurably impacts the gravity that we can measure,
we cannot measure that itself. We have to infer that something exists in that space. But we don't have any direct quantification because we can't. Our instruments don't work on this underlying substance of the universe.
So dark matter, dark energy is something that we can see its effects, but we can't directly observe, test it. We don't have the tools to look at it. So what we were talking about the other day, Kyle, was I was asking you about the naturalistic materialist position where all that exists is material. It's only matter of some sort, right?
Right.
So there's nothing spiritual. There's nothing behind it. There's nothing immaterial. But what you're suggesting is that now what we know from observable science is that we have this dark matter and dark energy, and that simply cannot really be explained from the materialist perspective.
No, it really can't. And I found another article that I found particularly interesting that was written by one of the NASA scientists that was actually part of the group that was trying to understand and define dark matter and dark energy. And in his sort of opening statement, he mentions that so many people feel that there is just some new dynamical fluid out there. They've given it a name and they call it quintessence. It makes up 75% of the universe, he says, and there is a lot of mathematical models used to describe it. But it has to be very strange stuff. It has to be, it has to have negative pressure and its equation of state. And no normal energy or normal matter can produce anything like that. And finally, some have even suggested that Einstein's theory of relativity, the gravitational theory that holds everything together, is simply fundamentally wrong and will have to be replaced, such that he goes on to say that crackpot ideas, or what they would have been labeled as crackpot ideas 10 years ago, are likely to now be published in some of the finest journals. So everyone's really, really confused on this topic.
Interesting. And so in what we're not saying, let me just say this to our listeners, what we're not saying is that we're arguing for the God of the gaps. Like, we don't understand something, and so let's slip God in there. No, what we're actually saying is something quite different. We're arguing about the God of the facts, right? The one and only true God who has revealed himself in creation that gives us an ability to even make sense of this discussion. But the point is you bring up dark matter and dark energy. Explain to us why that should have any interest to us as Christians in terms of this discussion about God and science.
So this points out the idea that we need to understand that we have to have some fundamental basis for evaluating the universe around us and understand that because out of all of this stuff in the universe, we can only understand some percentage of the 5% that we can measure directly. We have to accept the idea that we can never understand all things. At some certain point, all of your best models, all of your best approaches to everything are going to come down to a point of a choice regarding faith. You have to believe one thing or another. You cannot simply, as Dawkins says, look at evolution and go, oh yeah, the evolutionary tree is exactly what we should believe in. That's clearly not supported.
So let me ask you this. So Dawkins says that about the model that we should be appealing to and holding to, and he says it with certainty. It's dogma from his perspective. Yeah. Can I ask you a question then, Kyle?
Sure.
How do we know now, based upon what we know in biological science, DNA, those sorts of things, how do we know that the Darwinian model is absolutely not true?
So my experience in labs, especially where we do genetic modification of bacteria, so-called metabolic engineering, it's something that we go in and change the information that's there in the particular genes of the bacteria so that we give them some sort of a different function. So we make them make some kind of a new product from the glucose that they're already consuming. So we're going in and changing the instruction set, sort of the underlying chemical code that operates all of the cells, all of the living cells. And we're going in and making changes to that, saying, instead of doing this, I want you to do this other thing to make a valuable product for my process. And we understand from all of this that DNA is not as simple as we once thought, just like a lot of the other things we continue to study in the universe. there's increasing complexity in all of these things, and especially in terms of genetics. At one point in time, I was taught the term junk DNA, this idea that there's extra DNA floating around in you that does absolutely nothing. We have no idea why it's there. It's clearly just left over from when we had, I don't know, tails. Well,
that's what I was taught.
Was taught as science at one point. Now that's regarded as laughable, just like true core Darwinian evolution is. It's now we understand that there's a lot more structure and function on sort of secondary and even tertiary or third levels of genetic regulation, such that genes aren't just like in the central dogma of molecular biology. It goes from DNA gets transcribed to RNA, which gets encoded to build proteins. And that's kind of the core of everything we understand in biology. And evolution seeks to sort of go backwards from that and go, well, these ingredients were just there because of watered down rocks in this theoretical environment that must have necessarily existed this very specific way in order for these chemicals to react when struck by lightning, because they washed off the backs of all these different kinds of crystals that clearly were there because meteorites smashed together and then an amino acid formed, and then that somehow developed into its own machinery to make RNA then go backwards to DNA. And so those two are fundamentally in contradiction to each other.
Right.
And so we cannot, even in, I think it was in 1954, they tried, or 1953, there was an experiment called the Miller-Urey experiment, which sought to generate a protein or an amino acid rather from special gases and materials that must have been present in this sort of ancient ocean. So they put together all these materials and then struck it with a very high voltage pulse to simulate a lightning strike. And they made an amino acid out of these theoretical conditions. That's really not heavily focused on anymore, because that doesn't really make the point that all of the central dogma of biology points to. It tries to go backwards. And so there's been a lot of experiments to try and demonstrate evolution, but even in some of the other ones that I've read about that were fairly fascinating, like this long-term evolution experiment that was started in 1988 by Richard Lenski over at Michigan State, he sought to see if he could change the feed source for bacteria to feed on a different substrate, a different food source for them, basically. And after, I think he closed this experiment in 2010, he did manage to grow E. coli that were able to adapt and use this other feedstock. But it was interesting because that pathway already existed. It just didn't happen when the bacteria grew in the presence of oxygen. It was grown without the presence of oxygen. So he didn't change the organism itself. It didn't suddenly become a yeast cell and do something different. It's still an E. coli cell. It's now just doing something it already knew how to do under a different set of condition because of some kind of a mutation.
And that's a good point to talk about. If we can, everyone's probably like, well, okay, my brain's blowing up here. Stay with us, because this is really, really important. I want to talk about two things there, Kyle, that came out of what you said, at least from my perspective. And that is, first and foremost, you talked about DNA and junk DNA and those descriptions in the past. But what we've actually discovered is that there's real information in the cell. There's real information there. And we thought that there was even information that was just a leftover vestige of our evolutionary past. And what we've discovered is that it's so complex and so much sophisticated information that it's actually communicating at different levels where it actually is important information and code that's so sophisticated that if it runs into an error, that information is able to communicate, right?
Yeah.
There's logic happening.
There is. And there are actually, like, for instance, some of the things that happen when you go out and stay out in the sun too long and you get really sunburned, you're getting a lot of heavy UV exposure. That UV light fundamentally breaks down DNA. And if it weren't for these sort of natural repair mechanisms that are looking at some of the secondary and tertiary level information and going back and saying, oh, wait, this segment of DNA is wrong. It has a break or it has a mutation. We need to go back and correct this. Without that, we would be just these massive blobs of cancer walking around because there'd be no mechanism to regulate and repair the damages that are being done to our DNA constantly all day long.
So what you're saying, Kyle, is that you have at the bottom of life information and communication taking place that is sophisticated, that demonstrates intellect, right? And at some level here, we're talking about logic, right? Logical communication happening in the cell at the bottom of life.
Yeah, it even happens between bacteria, as a matter of fact. So these bacteria, when they're trying to form, when they're trying to infect someone or trying to form a biofilm on some sort of a surface, they're trying to attach, they're making proteins that are sent out into the matrix around the cells to other proteins to signal, hey, you need to do this, you need to attach here, you need to make more of this kind of protein because that's how I'm sticking to this surface. And so in this, even in the most simple bacterial cell, we see this kind of communication, and it's referred to as quorum sensing. It's something that happens all the time. Not all organisms do this, but we've seen it definitely in the case of bacteria. And so we observe now that there are multiple levels of communication with DNA. It's not just as simple as the linear code being interpreted. There's higher levels of logic such that it's almost like there's if-else statements built into sort of the secondary levels of the DNA.
Right. Crazy.
Did you say?
Wild.
Did you say they're sending information into the matrix? I knew it.
I did say. To clarify, I'm referring to the extracellular matrix.
Yeah. So yes.
It's complex mash of a lot of different chemical compounds, DNA, cellular debris, amino acids, proteins, all of these things just whizzing around in between cells. There's a lot of stuff going on.
And so what's interesting here is we're not saying that you can communicate this stuff to an atheist and that's going to convert them. It takes a spirit of God, God granting repentance. The problem is fundamentally sin. But what we are saying is a Romans 1 kind of thing, that all of creation is shouting to you about God, testifying to you about God. What we are saying is that when Dawkins says this stuff is absolute scientific dogma and fact and certainty, what we're saying is answer the fool according to their folly. We stepped into their position. We say, okay, granted, I'll look at the observational evidence and here's what I see. You're wrong. You're wrong. Absolutely wrong. And what's interesting there, Kyle, and I'm going to get to my second point there too, but in terms of the information that's there, information comes from a mind. Language comes from a mind.
Immaterial.
And also that information there is at bottom, all information is immaterial. You might have the physical representation of the information, but that's not the thing.
Right.
The information itself is immaterial. And so that can't be made sense of with a naturalistic materialist position. But it sounded like you were saying that there is communication at the cellular level with information that it actually communicates in different dimensions, in a sense. There are different dimensions of communication.
Yeah, it definitely does. And it's remarkable how similar to a computer code that you might learn genetics really is. And it's not as directly linear as a lot of our languages are. It's far, far more complicated than that. And to that point, I did some quick maths, as the British love to say, because that's, I guess, a more entertaining way to say it, or they just love extra letters. I'm not really sure. I looked up the information density of DNA just to give people some kind of an idea.
This is get ready. You guys get ready. If you checked out, right now, I don't care what you're doing, stop. Listen to this. It's going to blow your mind.
Right. I might have to repeat it twice just so that people really understand it. So the information density of DNA as we understand it right now is about 2.2 petabytes per gram. So this is something that, to try and put that into a frame of reference people can maybe understand, there's kind of a known density of DNA, and it's like 1.4 grams per milliliter. So using that volume as an estimate, the Facebook data center is estimated to have something like 100 petabyte storage capacity, and this is a number from 2013, so this is a little bit outdated in terms of current capacity, but they, to store the entire capacity of Facebook, all of it, the whole thing, that's 100 petabytes. So you could store, in terms of DNA, if you were to transcode that same information, in about 33 milliliters, or for us Americans who don't know what that is, that's about 2 tablespoons. That's not a lot. That's just a little bitty, just a little handful of DNA could contain the entirety of Facebook.
All the data, comment sections, posts, pictures, videos.
Everything.
Everything.
The video, the all of it.
Everything in data in Facebook, 100 petabytes. And yeah. that would equate to, in that's your palm of your hand, 2 tablespoons of DNA.
Of DNA, yeah. You literally would be able to hold that amount in your hand. Now let's tackle a little bit bigger example. Google's data capacity from a 2013 estimate was about 10 exabytes, or about 10,240 petabytes. That means that the entire capacity of Google for that time would require about 333 milliliters of volume, which means in an average water bottle, you could store Google twice. In a large Starbucks cup, you could store more than 2 Googles worth of information in terms of DNA.
What DNA?
All of Google.
All
their
of Google.
Their entire capacity.
In a water bottle. With that, that's how sophisticated, amazing, mind-blowing DNA is.
And that's amazing.
From what I understand, that is literally just the information density of the linear code.
Can I ask you a question?
Go for it.
Is there any way we can take all that information and get me some hard drives that are filled like that? Because
we need that here.
We go through hard drives like crazy.
Well, and that's actually a fantastic point that you bring up, Marcus. Can you give people some kind of an idea what it would take for you to fill, even, for instance, let's say just 1 petabyte, because as I understand that
that's
right now, as I understand it, it's about 1,000 terabytes. With all the video and audio and really large file formats that you guys use, how long would it take you to fill that? Because my current understanding is that's roughly like 1 full-size server rack full of drives. Roughly.
Yeah, so we probably go through maybe like 2 to 3 5-terabyte hard drives a month. So maybe 15 terabytes a month.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be, what, 15 times 12?
Yeah.
Is that 60? I'm awful.
You're still a good few years.
Yeah, it's about 10 years.
Yeah, you're still,
much, yeah.
Yeah, you're still years to fill. Just,
and that's multiple cameras and audio.
But I'm telling you, if I had that space, right? I would find a way to fill it up.
Sure.
I would record in 4K 10-bit raw everything.
Right.
I mean, I'd fill it up.
But all of that, still, even just talking 1 petabyte, that's roughly a half a gram of DNA.
That's insane.
You could fit that all in a very small volume. That amount of DNA would literally fit inside of your click pen in the empty space.
Wow.
Right.
I have a question for you. So you mentioned that we can measure roughly 5% of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Does the 95% that we cannot measure, does that include this information that you're speaking of? Or is that just dark matter?
The way that I understand it as it's being related right now is that's primarily what they're referring to as dark energy and dark matter. Mm-hmm. And that it's about 90% of the energy and 5% of the matter, as I understand it presently, is sort of missing because they don't know what to do
right.
with it.
Okay, so then all this information that ultimately is the underlying force, if you will, behind life, they have no way of measuring, essentially.
Or
testing.
This majority of the information to describe the universe, we were unable to attain information on that right now because we don't know how to measure it. We don't know what it is. And so one of the things that I thought was interesting is, and Jeff has pointed out that the atheists tend to be very much purely material. There's nothing really spiritual. This is all just a bunch of nonsense, right? Well, what happens to sort of these laws that govern these interactions, and with those being potentially immaterial, is this stuff, this 95% of the substance of the universe, is that itself immaterial? And a bunch of scientists will immediately claim, if you look on a bunch of the blogs and things, they'll immediately claim, no, that's not immaterial. That's not a thing. They'll turn around and answer a similar question with, well, we really don't know what all this stuff is. And I found another article that really dug into some of the theory behind it and put a bunch of equations to it. And the sum total of that was that matter that as we measure it using, again, particle physics, and I won't go into a lot of details, it's just things like the Hadron Collider, where you smash atoms together and things fly off of those collisions, particles, very, very fine particles with masses and moments of inertia that we can measure and quantify. That's how we begin to try and understand these really small things. Matter doesn't scatter these, dark matter doesn't scatter these kinds of inertial mass objects, so we can't measure it, is what this article was saying. And that makes it undetectable. And this sort of establishes the very framework for the definition of the term immaterial, something that we cannot measure because it cannot exist. We can only infer it exists. And simultaneously, as they're presenting this, they are appealing to an absolute law regarding how matter itself must be defined rigorously.
Mm.
So you have to have some kind of, again, foundational absolute to compare this against, because when you start talking about 95% of the things influencing our universe we cannot understand, you need to really begin to question your worldview and your understanding of the nature of the universe around
it. Yeah, no, I think the point is as we discover further the nature of dark matter and dark energy and all these discussions about immaterial, from a Christian perspective, I can have a universe that has material and immaterial aspects. So it can make sense in my worldview, dark matter, dark energy, and immaterial realm that we're discovering. Not from the atheist perspective and dogma. That doesn't make sense from a materialist position. So final question here, Kyle, at least for today's episode, we'll probably do this a lot more. Final question, and it was my second point I wanted to make. When we look at the information that's underlying all of life and all these details and the complexity and the information storage and communication and logic taking place at the bottom of life, the machinery, the mechanics, I mean, there's technology down there in the human body and in life that we can't do. We can't do what this stuff is doing.
Mm-hmm.
We're learning from it. As a matter of fact, there's a whole field today, basically back engineering DNA and life to figure out how can we get our computers to communicate like this? How can we store information the way that the human body does?
Mm-hmm.
And so the point is that it's sophisticated and complex on a level that we haven't even been able to attain yet. And so Dawkins gives as dogma, because he's into scientism, this is certainty. Darwin had it right. This is the way things are. But Kyle, now that we are unpacking these things and we're getting down to discover God's creative masterpiece, one of the things that's suggested is that we came from highly evolved societies of bacteria. We moved, and there was fish, and then we moved from there to up into onto the land, and you know we're African apes, and then there's speciation taking place where we're talking about one thing turning into another. Now, I want to ask you, Kyle, with DNA, what we know of information down there, aren't there markers on the ends, basically, that say this far and only this far? I mean, change and mutation can take place within that code, within a species, but it is literally impossible to change from one type of creature to, like, from a cat to a human. As a quick example, sure. No one's suggesting that's what we're saying. What we're saying is that in terms of the information and language down there and the coding, it's not possible to change into another thing.
Right. There has been a lot of work, and to be clear, I don't know all possible permutations of this particular area of literature. I'm familiar with it, but there has been a lot of push to put together what they call the synthetic organism. And so they've taken things like stem cells and they've applied specific environmental pressures and learned how to diversify those into all these different kinds of cells. And they want to sort of point to that and go, aha, see, that's evolution. But yes, you can use selective pressure in order to change the behavior of an organism under certain conditions, but you're not changing the actual organism itself. So to kind of bring that down to a simplified example, if the code that's marked by a start and a stop codon, which is kind of what you're referring to, it's something that the ribosome comes and binds to the DNA at this specific spot where it's this specific code that says start here, replicate all the way up to this point. You can have mutations of the specific gene, which is contained between the start and the stop codon. You can change the information that's between them such that maybe it's telling the E. coli to grill chicken, right? Well, an example that we talked about is you could take that out and say, how about you make steak tacos instead? You're still going to be grilling the steak. You've changed what the information is, but you haven't changed the organism itself, and you haven't changed the method by which it's going to make it. If you ask it to sous vide duck eggs, it's going to go, say what? And it's not going to understand what to do, so that gene is going to not function right in the organism. So there's a lot of cases where there are proteins and things that cannot be made by E. coli, even if you give them the genetic information, because they fundamentally lack the machinery.
Right.
And so you can't, there's a lot of proteins that you can express in an insect cell that you can't express in a bacterial cell. And so there's fundamental differences in the way eukaryotes and prokaryotes, so the cells like you and I have and the bacteria, there's fundamental differences in the way that those behave.
Yeah.
But there is an overall conservation in a lot of the elements of design. And from our worldview, that points to a very clever and creative creator who's using commonality to show, look, I can take this one gene and make it do all these different things in these different organisms. And I can take this one type of gliding wrist joint, for instance, that's in humans and all of these other animals, but it's also in the fearsome and powerful lion, for instance. But that's a very particularly weak joint prone to injury. It's something that has a tendency to heal very well and heal with full flexion and extension, but it's a very weak sort of a joint. So it's confusing as to why a mechanism like that would have evolved in such a powerful animal. But there's a lot of examples like that. There's conservations of things in the overall design of nature, and that points to a creative creator that has a good idea how to do a lot of different things from one single tool.
That's right. And just so last word here and quickly on this as we're wrapping up the show, isn't evolution itself, natural selection, isn't it a calling force, right? Like it's not building new machinery, right? It's not building an eyeball. It's not creating the fit. It's getting rid of the unfit. In a sense.
Yeah, they really push, especially natural selection. And I think that if natural selection were a rigorous law of the universe, probably our world would be very differently shaped than it is right now. I also think it's very internally inconsistent for a lot of these atheists with some of their hippy-dippy baloney to be so hung up on conservation of wildlife and animals and things, because that's internally inconsistent with their own worldview. They should let them die off and use their resources for other things. And if you're really concerned about the CO2 buildup in the atmosphere and all of these other things, well, really, from your worldview, you should probably stop breathing and things. So there's a lot of internal inconsistencies with these worldviews that people don't really want to pay attention to. My worldview explains very clearly that there's an intelligent creator who set all of these things about. And to be clear, I'm not trying to claim that, oh, dark matter and dark energy is God. There, solved. Because I think that the people that want to try and reconcile man's attempt to explain away God and the nature of God by following things like theistic evolution, you believe in a God that's just a serial screw-up. He can't get anything right. He has to fumble his way through designing things. So you don't believe in the God of the Bible that I believe in either.
Wow. Oh, wow. That was a profound way to put that, Kyle. That's good.
I'm sure the YouTube comments will just blow up on that.
No, that's good.
Whatever.
It's good. It's important. It's important. and it's a good conversation to have. Super smart Kyle, PhD.
Wow.
That was awesome. Kyle, you're amazing. Thanks for blessing us, man. We got to have you in more often.
Well, thank you guys for having me. It was fun.
Absolutely.
Fun to kind of poke back at the atheists since we don't seem to have a lot of voices on our side.
Yes, that's right. Well, we plan to do it more and more, and God has given us a voice, so we're going to do it. All right, Joy the Girl. I know you love this episode.
I do.
Yes.
This is totally my thing.
Yeah, it's totally Joy's thing. She loves it.
Totes.
Totes. She spends hours and hours on Creation Ministries International. She likes to just read. And let me just say this real fast. You guys can't see today. Obviously, it's a radio show. But I'm assuming that that's a total nerd joke shirt. It's a shirt with all kinds of, periodic table of elements stuff. There's three things. So, Kyle, tell us whatever does your shirt mean. I'm sure it's something profound.
Actually, it's just a simple example of taking some of these words because someone had way too much time on their hands and making words out of periodic elements.
Okay.
And so this one is just bacon. It's not a specific compound, but it's really entertaining watching people who have had 1 year of chemistry figure out what on earth it could be.
So it's actually a jab at super smart people. It's like it's not as complex as you think. It just says bacon.
Mm. It is. That's why it's
I'm down.
Well, I love bacon, so very good. And bacon is actually very complex. All right, guys, so that was Kyle, PhD. Thanks for joining us. Luke the Bear and Marcus King Ginger Pittman.
Make sure you watch next week.
That's right, next week.
Tuesdays,
10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. God's blessing that big time. Share it with us, guys.
Hit the share button.
Hit the share button. Let the world know there's a show with the unpopular opinion, and that's going to get better and better and better, guys. As we get better with using the technical stuff and getting used to the show, we're just excited about where we're going to take it. So thank God for that. Thank God for all of you guys that participate with us. Don't forget to share the episode. Share it with an atheist. Tell them you love them. We love them. And we want them to know Jesus, God, who died and rose again for sinners to know God and have peace with God through faith in Jesus. That's it, y'all. So apologiaradio.com. Share an episode, y'all. Catch you next week. What's up, y'all? This is Jeff Durbin with Apologia Radio at apologiaradio.com. Want to talk to you guys about an amazing connection that we have right now with Whitfield Theological Seminary. I want you to run over to whitfield.edu, whitfield.edu, whitfield.edu. I want you to check out the programs they have. They have undergraduate programs at Whitfield College, and they also have Whitfield Theological Seminary for the graduate degree and above and beyond. I think you'll really be impressed with the rigorous nature of the classes, the consistent biblical worldview taught and adhered to. I want you to contact Whitfield Theological Seminary at whitfield.edu. Get a hold of our friend, Dr. Kenneth Talbot, and start your classes today. ApologiaRadio.com.